He's the Yajna Purusha. Ritualistic Brahmins are trying to achieve. They all have their ultimate shelter in him anyway. In this world, he can control all beings. The two-legged human beings and demigods, and the four-legged animals, like the horses and the cows. He's the super soul present in every one of their hearts. So who should we worship? That self-manifest Supreme Lord. And if we can't properly worship him in the traditional way, by offering the detailed rituals in the fire sacrifice, at least we should serve him by self-surrender. If we're not competent to perform yoga or ritual sacrifice in the expert, proper way, then we have no choice to simply surrender to his mercy. Throw ourselves at his feet, at the feet of his devotees, and ask for mercy, because we're not competent to do anything else properly. In any case, we should worship him, not any other deity. After describing how the Lord, Supreme Person, is all-pervading in the universe, and is directly in control of everything. Text 14.
Sukshmati sukshmam kalilasya manye vishvasya shashtaram aneka rupam vishvasyaikam pariveshtitaram gyatva shivam shantim atyantaneti.
He is subtler than the subtlest, present within the complex combinations of creation. He created the universe and assumes many forms within it. He alone pervades everything. One who knows this auspicious Lord achieves endless peace.
Okay, here, the phrase is sukshmati sukshmam, more subtle than the subtlest.
We had before anoraniyati, smaller than the smallest, same idea. He can enter the most subtle things. The material elements, earth, water, fire, air, ether, and then the mind, intelligence, ego. They're each of them more subtle than the one before. Earth is the most gross. And the more subtle the substance is, the harder it is to understand. So the word subtle, sukshma, has two meanings. It means fine, physically fine, but it also means difficult to understand. And then more subtle than these are the five tanmatras, the hankara. The tanmatras are the raw perceptions that are experienced in these various elements. In earth, there is fragrance, smell. That's the tanmatra, the perception found in the earth. In the water, there's taste. In the fire, there's visible form. In the air, there's touch. And in the ether, there's sound. These are the five tanmatras. They're more subtle. They're just perceptions. How do you measure them? What's the weight? What's the size of the perception? It's a purely mental existence. Beyond that is the false ego, which is even more subtle. And then the original form of nature, Mahatattva, and then even more, a more primary, the Pradhan, in which not even the three modes are manifest. Everything is in complete equilibrium with Pradhan. This is the most subtle. But the Paramatma, the Supreme Person, is more subtle than all of those. He's the most inner. He's inside everything. Because he's the ultimate impeller of all activity. All the elements are active because of his presence within. Therefore, he has to be understood as present within everything. And he has to be the most subtle, the most smallest, in order to enter within everything. He's the organizer of all the energies in existence. Everything emanates from him. Therefore, he's very difficult to understand. what underlies everything, what is invisible behind the workings of everything, that is extremely difficult to understand. One can see an automobile in the street, and you notice the shiny color. Here's a big red automobile, and the headlights are burning, and it's coming at me very fast. I know what it is. I get out of the way. I don't stand in front of it. It's not hard to understand. Here's this big thing, even a cat or a dog. A little bird recognizes this big machine is coming toward me, and I should get out of its way. But who can understand the inner workings of that machine? Only an expert mechanic can understand how the engine of the machine actually works. The driver, when the car breaks down, the driver may open the hood and poke around, but he usually doesn't know what he's doing. An expert, only a rare expert, knows the inner workings of the car, the more subtle aspects. So what is more subtle, what is inside, is always harder to understand. The Supreme Lord is the most subtle. He's inside everything, underlying everything, the inner workings of everything. He's the most difficult to understand. So, since he's so impossible to understand, what evidence is there of his existence? How can he be known at all? Well, he's present in the expansions of Maya, of ignorance. His presence can be noticed by the symptoms. By the way his energies work in this world, we can understand his presence. We can understand him as the creator of this world. That's why so much emphasis is given to explaining how to meditate on him in these forms, as the creator, as the impeller, as the maintainer and controller of everything. These are just material aspects. And pure devotees who have some attraction to his personal pastimes may be disinterested in these explanations. But they're important for those who are very attached to the material world. It's all they know. So they can begin to condition souls, even the advanced jnanis who don't have an attraction to the Lord's personality. They are given the opportunity to begin understanding the personality of Godhead by understanding how he works in the material world, how he is the creator in the super soul. That's the basic substance of the knowledge that's being given here so repetitively over and over again, the same facts. So it's just like we hear from Prabhupada, you're not this body. We have to hear it a million times. But these sages, they know they're not this body. They're, you know, at the beginning, they're asking questions to show that they already understand the difference between spirit and matter. They know there is an absolute truth, but they're confused about the actual nature of this absolute truth. What is the one that, from which everything emanates, which controls everything, and because of which we're suffering in this material world? That they don't know. So they don't have to be told they're not this body, but they do have to be told over and over again, there's a person, the Supreme Person, who's the controller of everything. That's the Absolute. So by knowing him, who is one without a second, he's the bestower of eternal auspiciousness. He's capable of giving peace. One will attain that eternal peace of no more rebirth by knowing him, by directly realizing him through devotional service. Of course, just theoretical knowledge won't bring eternal peace. So knowledge, the word yapa here has to mean knowing him in the sense of realizing him in a mood of devotion. Krishna says that yapa mam shanti vishyati. Bhaktaram yakatapasam. Similar statement by Krishna. Those who know me to be the Lord, actually it's right here on the top of page 83 under the verse. Bhaktaram yakatapasam. Sarva loka maheshwaram. Suridam sarva bhutanam gyatva mam shanti vishyati. A person in full consciousness of me, knowing me to be the ultimate beneficiary of all sacrifices and austerities, the Supreme Lord of all planets and demigods, and the benefactor and well-wisher of all living entities, attains peace from the pangs of material miseries. That kind of knowledge is not just dry theoretical knowledge. That's devotional service. We have to understand Krishna is the absolute controller and he's our best friend. That's the basis of devotional service, that realization. Okay, verse 15.
Sa eva kale bhuvanasya gupta vishvaripa sarva bhuteshu gura yasmin yukta vamoshayo devatascha tameva gyatva mityupasham chidati.
He alone maintains the universe for the duration of its existence. He is the ruler of all, hidden within the heart of every creature. The sages among the Brahmins and the demigods are all his servants. One who knows him, who thus knows him, will break free from the bondage of death. So, Paramatma is that person in whom the sages who know what is Brahman, not just professional sadhus who put on saffron just so they can get some free chapati, but the persons who are actually Brahman realized, they engage their minds in the service of the Supreme Person and the demigods all. That is the qualification of a demigod. If you want to become a ruler of the universe, if you want to participate in the administration of the universe and go and live on the heavenly planets, you have to become Krishna's devotee. That is the qualification. So, Kali, which means during the time that the universe is manifest, is visible, during the time of maintenance of the universe, he's the protector of all the worlds. And he gives special protection. Gopta is the protector. He gives special protection by giving liberation to his devotees. And how can he do this? What is his qualification? He's Vishwadipa, the Lord of everything, the controller of everything. He's hidden in every being, every living being, and every material thing. And, you know, let me get to another sentence. And then he's the whole of which everything is a part. Everything is part and parcel of him. Yeah.
I was going to ask.
A devotee. Yes. The demigods are cooperative. They understand the laws of nature and the laws of God, and they're good citizens. Therefore, they can be appointed to responsible positions. They have material desires. They're called sakama bhaktas. Devotees with motives, but they're devotees. They serve Krishna. They can be trusted with some important service.
Are there
Gyanis they're not aiming at becoming demigods, they're aiming at becoming sages, you know, live on the planets of the sages above. So they may be impersonalists, the Gyanis, many of them are. They recognize the Supreme Truth but don't recognize his personal aspect. The people who are generally aiming to become demigods, they're the karmis. And they may have superficially recognized Krishna. You know, the deity of Krishna is there, and they say, oh, yes, this is God. That God provides our daily bread. We do our sacrifice and he gives us everything we need. So their idea of God is the universal order supplier. It's a personal conception. That's a very self-centered conception. So the karmis, who can be elevated to become the demigods by performing sacrifices very properly, they may be theists. They may acknowledge God, but it's like the modern religions that pay lip service to God, but don't give up their materialism. Then God, instead of you being the part and parcel of God, you try to make God your part and parcel. He's there just to serve you. That's materialistic conception. Right. But going back to the commentary, everything is related to God. Is the relationship to part and whole. Part and whole, not just mechanically, but everything, just like a machine in its parts. The
parts of a machine, of a clock, the gears and the wheels of the clock, all serve special purposes. They serve the whole, the clock. It's not an aimless combination of things, like a pile of rocks. So everything serves as a particular service to render as a part of the whole. It's that kind of relationship. Every part is meant to serve. And it's a relationship also of body and soul. Just like my body, I can claim it's my body because I know it and it's under my control. Unless I'm paralyzed or I forget how to move my hand, it moves according to my will. My feet go where I want them to go unless I'm diseased. So I can say my body is under my control and I know my body. I don't know it completely. But the pains are my pains, the pleasures are my pains, the pleasures. And I know, you know, I can feel my fingers and my toes. I'm aware of my own body. But similarly, God, the Supreme Person, is absolutely in control of everything that exists, both spiritual and material. And He knows everything, just like we know our own fingers and toes, directly. So we can say, and Ramanujacharya likes to say, that everything spiritual and material comprises the body of God. And He's the soul of everything. Not just as a super soul, but in a more complete sense. Everything makes up His body. Because of that, because He's the whole and everything is the part meant to serve Him, and because everything is His body, He is capable, therefore, of giving liberation. Because liberation is simply restoring the part to its proper function. The part is that the spring pops out of the clock. The clock repairman puts the spring back where it belongs. Or if it's broken, he replaces it. So like that, we've popped out of our proper place in service to the Supreme. When he reinstalls us back where we belong, that's liberation. That's what we call liberation. Because we're His parts and parcels, and He's capable of controlling us, He's certainly capable of giving liberation. Why can't He be perceived then? Because He's hidden. He chooses to hide Himself within all the living entities. He also hides Himself within the material elements, earth and so on. He's present, but His own maya, His material energy, covers Him over so we cannot see Him. But when we learn to see Him, when we realize Him within the material elements, within our own heart, our own mind, then we can become liberated by finding Him out where He's hidden. And there's evidence that this has been done. This process is possible. There are persons who have been successful. Great Brahmarshis like Bhrigu Muni, who know Brahman, demigods like Indra, they've been able to concentrate their minds in samadhi on the Supersoul, Paramatma. They've attained their demigod and sage positions. They've been elevated to high planets because they have this realization of the Supersoul. So if they can do it, we can do it also. It's possible to find the Lord where He's hidden. Vitupashan Shanati. Then we can break out of the bonds of death. Yamaraj claims everybody, but not the devotees. So we can get out of the category of those who have to go to Yamaraj by becoming God conscious. By ordinary pious works, one only goes to a demigod planet. But by becoming God conscious, you can get out of that entanglement and leave this material world completely. Okay. Next verse. 16. There's a mistake in the translation. I'll point it out if I read the verse. Gritat paramandamivati sukshmam gatva shivam sarvabhuteshu gunam Vishwasyaikam Harivishitaram Gatva Devam Muchyate Sarvapashai. As ghee is distinct from the residue, here's the mistake.
It's not residue of butter fat it leaves behind. I didn't properly translate the word mandam. Mandam means that ordinary ghee can be further distilled. And there's a refined essence of ghee. I don't know what that is, but it's called mandam. So as ghee is distinct from its distilled, refined essence, so the auspicious Lord is the most subtle. There's a special refined distilled essence of ghee. It's different than ordinary ghee. In that way, the Supreme Lord is the most subtle, like that pure essence of ghee. One who knows that effulgent Lord, the one pervader of the universe, hidden within all creatures, becomes free from all bondage. The first line is the only new line here. The other three lines are repeated from other verses. Although the Lord is present, He's all-pervading everywhere, He's still perfectly pure. He's all-auspicious. You need to translate the phrase? It's, as ghee is distinct from the from its pure distilled essence. So manda, the word manda means the essence of ghee. This is a mundane example to help us understand how the Lord is even more subtle than the ether, even more subtle than the jiva soul. He enters within all forms of life, all consciousness, and sustains that consciousness. As Krishna says in the Gita, Matak smitir gyanam apohanam cha. From me come knowledge, remembrance, and forgetfulness. He's regulating and facilitating our consciousness from moment to moment. He enters our consciousness in order to do that. By knowing the Supreme Lord in these various aspects, His subtle control, not just controlling physically, grossly, but very, very subtle control, even of the consciousness of the living beings. And meditating on this, one becomes free from the bonds of death. Yeah. He's... Okay. This verse can be understood as answering two questions. What evidence is there of the existence of God? And what shows, what proves that He's the original Creator? So this verse focuses on the image of the most subtle essence of everything, the most pure, perfect essence of existence. Hidden within everybody's heart, which has been stated four different times in four different verses. Although he's inside everything, he's also outside everything. He surrounds, envelops the whole existence from without, which means that he exists. He's not only existing to maintain this material world, he has his own existence beyond it, his own life, his own world. Okay. Any questions? No, that at least behind should be crossed out. That part, that phrase should be crossed out. That was part of the mistake, that it leaves behind. See, I was originally thinking... Well, if A is distinct from B, then B is distinct from A. The two are distinct from each other. Well, originally I had it backwards. I was thinking of when you make ghee, there's butter solids left behind. If they're the refuse, you throw them out. They're salty and, you know, and nobody wants them. You know, they're gross. But actually it's the other way around. You take ghee that's already made and you can further distill it and get a pure essence of ghee. So the phrasing is backwards because I originally had the logic backwards. You can correct that if you want, yeah. Some of the original ghee, you could say that.
Okay.
17.
Esha Devo Vishwakarma Mahatma Sadajananam Vidaye Sanivishtaha Vidhamanisha Manasami Klipto Ya Eta Vidur Amitas Te Bhavanti.
Here also the last three lines are repeats. Only the first line is new. This Supreme Lord is the creator and soul of the universe. He is always present in the hearts of all persons. He is realized by exercise of the heart, the intelligence, and the mind. Those who know him become immortal. So again, it's being asked, if the Lord is so hidden, so hard to know, how can he be known at all? What's the process for knowing him? Well, he's the same effulgent Lord who's been described elaborately in these verses. So he can be described, he can be known theoretically, as the creator who, as his pastime, manifests this world. The word deva means he's playful. So one of his sports, one of his enjoyments is to create the material world. For him it's a sport. For us, it's serious business. For him it's just playing, creating this world. He's the creator of this universe, the manifester of all the elements we see. So he can be known through these manifestations. We know, we can argue, logically, everything that exists has a creator, like a pot. Somebody made the pot. There's one story of about Isaac Newton, who was a believer in God, but he was a scientist at a time, the end of the 17th century, when some scientists were beginning to become atheists. Before that, earlier in the 17th century, before that, if you openly admitted you were an atheist, you'd usually get burned at the stake. But there was more liberalism by that time, especially in England. So Isaac Newton had to contend with fellow scientists who were atheists, and he wasn't. So one day one of his atheist friends came to him, and Isaac Newton showed him a mechanical model of the solar system that he had acquired, made very expertly engineered out of brass. And the friend was amazed. This is a very expert thing. Here are the planets rotating around the sun in proper orbits. Yeah. And he asked, very wonderful machine, who made it? And Isaac said, nobody made it. It just fell out of the sky when I picked it up. And the friend said, this is ridiculous. How could such a complex machine have nobody making it? And Isaac laughed at him. He said, you, my friend, you think that nobody made the universe. Now, it's much more complex than this simplified model. So that way he was arguing from the fact, this is a common argument for the existence of God, everything, especially everything that has any sense to it, that has any purpose, must be designed and manufactured by somebody, like a pot, like some machine. So the universe, much more elegant and complex and meaningful than a simple pot or even a clock or some other machine. Somebody must have designed it and put it together. Some intelligence. That's an argument for a logical argument for the existence of the Supreme Person, the Supreme Intelligence. So there are various ways to know God from the material manifestations. And then for those who can practice yoga, they can find him as present in all levels of consciousness. In wakeful consciousness, in sleep, in deep sleep, God is present. And the yogis can seek him out in the different levels of consciousness. He becomes manifest. He can be found. Abhiklipta, he's realized by three processes that is mentioned again here. Rida, Manisha, Manasa. So I translate them simply as exercise of the heart, the intelligence of the mind, because that's the literal translation. But in one of the commentaries, there's a more technical translation or explanation of these three words. Rit can be understood as tatvagyan, scientific knowledge, spiritual knowledge. It's called rit because it takes away ignorance.
arati. Vritti is what takes away something. So what takes away ignorance is factual knowledge of spirit. Manisha, which I translate as intelligence, can mean thoughtful contemplation as an adjunct, as a corollary of worship. When worships the Lord, you can perform arti or some sacrifice, but it's on a higher level when there's thoughtful contemplation accompanying that external worship, that mental exercise of thoughtfully pondering the glory of the Lord and thoughtfully making one's offerings within the mind. This is called manana, or manisha. And then manasa, by deeply meditating with one's inner heart. These are the three processes of God, of becoming God conscious. Cultivating factual spiritual knowledge, thinking very carefully about the nature of the Lord and His glories, and then going deep into the heart and fixing one's full attention on the Lord. Devotional meditation. This is what is called upasana, or devotional meditation. This is Krishna consciousness. Krishna consciousness may begin as an external activity. We're busy in Krishna consciousness, but the essence of Krishna consciousness is internal. It's the business of the heart. The advanced devotees are mainly engaged with their heart, with their deep consciousness, and at the same time they're externally engaged, but the essence of it is inside. The essence of Krishna consciousness. We're engaged mostly externally because we haven't opened up our internal consciousness yet. We're not purified enough yet. Next verse. So even though the sage is talking in less personal terms, and his students, his co-workers, may not understand things if he explains them more personally, but he's hinting at very devotional principles here. About devotional service as an inner concentration of the heart on the Supreme Person. He is referring to that. Then in the last verse, we'll see in the last verse of the last chapter, he finally calls it bhakti, devotional service. Now some descriptions, a few verses how the Lord is transcendental to the material existence. We've had a lot of emphasis how he's present to this world, now how he's existing beyond it also, beginning with verse 18. Yada tamastana divana ratrir na sana na cha sat shiva eva kevalaha tadaksharam tat savitur varenyam pagya cha tasmat prasvita purani. When there was only darkness, no day and no night, no visible forms or subtle causes of creation, then only He, the all auspicious Lord, is present by Himself. He is the incorruptible perfection, the most worshipful person seen in the sun. The timeless intelligence of the Vedas emanates from Him. So this is just showing the image of the universe during the time of annihilation, when nothing is present. So in the material world, only the Supreme Lord Himself, everything is dormant within Him during that time of annihilation. Of course, He's also simultaneously existing in the spiritual world. In the spiritual world, there's no darkness, and He's not really only by Himself. But that's the spiritual world. That world we don't know anything about. From our point of view, our materially centered point of view, at that time, there's nothing except for the Supreme, all by Himself, in total darkness. That's the time when there's no expansion of anything material, either visible or invisible. And that way, we can say there's no day and no night. Brahma and all the other creatures, moving and non-moving, are merged into Him. The soul of all, Narayan, alone, is present at that time. At that time, there's no inauspiciousness of perverted intelligence.
as there is in material life. All the living entities, even the great demigods and sages, are confused in the material world. All that confusion is put to sleep during the time of annihilation. There's only pure consciousness present. Of course, only the Lord is conscious at that time. This is comparable to the state of deep sleep. It's like the deep sleep of the whole universe. But even individually, every night, we experience deep sleep. It's a kind of pure state, because there's no agitation of the mind or even false ego. It's all, everything's asleep. And we wake, and we don't experience anything. Without senses, without even ego, we can't experience any things. It's a completely passive experience. But we were conscious during deep sleep, because the person wakes up and he says, "Oh, I slept so comfortably, I don't remember anything." So he remembers that he didn't remember anything. He remembers, he draws some consciousness because he remembers being deeply asleep, even though there was no content to that consciousness. That's a sort of reflection of spiritual existence. But it's not the same. Of course, it's just temporary, but not only that, it's in the mode of ignorance. It's not really spiritual. One is in contact with the Supersoul at that time, in an undistracted way. One's always in contact with the Supersoul. But during deep sleep, one experiences some bliss, because all the other, everything else is not present. You're not aware of the presence of anything else. So you did get some, you have some, you can bask in the light of the Supersoul and experience some refreshment from that in deep sleep. That's why we have to have some deep sleep every night to recover our, you know, from the fatigue of material existence. But it's a dull experience. And we're still, at that time, deeply covered by ignorance. We're embraced by the Supersoul, and we have no proper consciousness at that time. We don't recognize it. So that's not spiritual existence, deep sleep. Neither is the deep sleep of the universe. That's just a temporary condition between creations. Pradhana is equivalent to the causal ocean. I think the causal ocean remains there, but it's just inactive as a third. But the living entities, they all enter into the body with their karma and their desires. And the time factors also enter into the body. Because it comes out in this glance. He's understood through the Vedas. And the Vedic knowledge is originally initiated by him. Pragyacha tasmat. Prasvita Purani, the timeless intelligence of the Vedas emanates from him. And that knowledge of the Vedas is the knowledge how to return to him. How to regain one's proper position. Reassume one's proper function as a servant of the Supreme. That's the teaching of the Vedas. The Lord lets ignorance take over and cover everybody, but he also provides knowledge so they can become free from the ignorance. That's the knowledge of the Vedas. And that Vedic knowledge is eternal. It's always present. The beginning of creation, he always manifests it with the help of Brahma and Brahma's sons.
We go on to verse 19?
Yep.
Varenyam. Varenyam means most worshipful.
Of course, that is an allusion to the Gayatri Mantra. Tat savitur varenyam marga devasya dhimani. Tat savitur varenyam. Those three words are right from the Gayatri Mantra. But Varenya means most worshipful. Some devotees of Shiva, who are philosophical, may refer to the Sridhara Charapanta to prove their belief. I don't think, among not very educated people, I don't think it's known that well. It's not the most well-known Upanishad. So the common Hindu may only know a few verses from a few of the major Upanishads. Not everybody can quote people in Sridhara Charapanta. But somebody, you know, got some special education in philosophy, even though, and if he's a shy mind, he might. The sun is the inspirer of all intelligence, giver of light, the form of intelligence as well as physical light. We understand that the samhita, the original samhita, is the Supersoul. The sun is just his external representation. When we pray, when we chant the Gayatri Mantra, we're praying to the Lord as the Supersoul in the heart. He's in the heart, he's in the sun, same Supersoul. Or as the Chandogya Upanishad says, the same person who's in the eye, he's the person who's in the sun. Yes, they're considered the most authoritative scriptures, the first authorities. The Vedas in general, but most of the Vedas are not philosophical. The philosophical part is the Upanishad. So the most authoritative philosophy is contained in the Upanishad. And all other authorities will quote the Upanishad as evidence for their opinions.
Yeah.
Vedanta Sutra is basically a commentary on the Upanishad, but Vyasadeva has left many things unexplained, and he's expressed himself very concisely, so he needs a commentary. And different people with different philosophies have different commentaries on Vedanta. So, yes, the Upanishads can be misinterpreted in so many ways. The pure Vaishnavas have the proper explanation of Vedanta, of Upanishads. We go to the Sri Vaishnavas, Madhvites, and the those members of the bona fide Vaishnava Sampradaya, they're giving the proper explanation. Theistic explanation. Vedanta is a textbook of theism, theology, not of some fantastic theory that everything is one. That's not the real message of the Upanishad. That's a very convoluted, twisted interpretation. The Vaishnava Acharyas show how faulty it is in so many ways.
Okay, 19.
Nainam urdvam natiryancham namadye parijagrabhat natasya patima asti yasya nama mahadyashaha.
No one has taken hold of him by force, neither from above or sideways or in the middle. There is no one equal to him. His name is the source of infinite fame. So again, emphasizing his transcendental aspect, how he's beyond material existence. First, the previous verse was describing how he alone is present when there is no material manifestation. And now, how he can't be found by any ordinary means. He's beyond everything ordinary. No one has taken hold of him in any form, as a plant, an animal, or a human being. No one can identify him in any of these categories. Or else we could say that no one can understand him as present in any place at all, because he's all-pervading. You can't grab hold of him at any location because he's everywhere. Grab him on one place, he's slipped away and he's somewhere else. No one can take hold of that Parameshwara, the Supreme Lord.
We say a cow is an animal with four legs and a funny flap under his neck. So it distinguishes the cow from a two-legged animal or from a horse that doesn't have this flap, has a dewlap. This is putting cows into categories. That's okay if you have many things that are all cows. There are so many cows, so we can talk in general about cows. How do you talk about that which is unique? It doesn't fit into any category. What can you say about it? He's not comparable to anything. You can't say he's like the other cows, and he's not like the horses and the cats. Because there's no category in which the Supreme fits along with anything else. He's completely unique. So you cannot describe him by mere logic. Logic deals in categories, and he doesn't fit into any category. Natasya Patima, there's nothing he's compared to. So no, he cannot be delimited in time and space, that he's here and not there, at this time and not that. Then what is he, if he's not anywhere or any time present? What is he then? He is that which is unique and has no comparison. We can call him Mahadyasha, the one who possesses supreme fame, or the source of supreme fame. He whose greatness, whose fame, cannot be delimited in time or space. Now this verse I didn't mention is also from the Yajurveda, chapter 32. Okay, move on to verse 20. So these are negative verses saying how he can't be seen, he can't be compared to, but to emphasize that he's not some material thing, not to say that he's nothing or that he's nobody. Text 420, which is even more negative.
Na sandrishe tishtati rupamasya na chakshusha pashyati kaschanainam ridharidistam manasaya inam eva vidura vitaste bhavanti.
His form never reveals itself to ordinary vision.
No ordinary person has seen him with his own eyes. By exercise of the heart and mind, some have seen him sitting in the heart. Those who thus know him become immortal. So, the first half is negative. Nobody's seen him. He's never been in anybody's eyesight, and nobody has seen him with his own eyes. But the second half balances that by saying there are some who can see him in the heart by exercise of the heart. They can see him present in the heart. These are the people who become immortal. So it's rare to see him. Well, an ordinary person, most people are ordinary, they cannot see the Supreme. But the rare soul who follows the proper process, the proper guidance, he can see the Lord. To those who try to meditate on him, he awards liberation. If he was visible to ordinary material senses, then ordinary people would be able to see him. And it's not the fact. And it's not the Lord's desire. Those who envy him, want to avoid him, and even want to do violence to him, he hides himself from them, intentionally. Logically, yes. But the Lord transcends that logic and reveals himself. He can be realized by anyone whom he wants to reveal himself to. Yes. Because we can, although we're powerless, he can give us the adequate power to see him. He bestows it on us.
By nature?
By material nature. It's not our original nature. It's not our natural nature. This is our unnatural nature. Yeah. Yeah. The conditioned souls. Or everybody we know. Nobody, because nobody that we know, no ordinary person, has seen the Lord. There's another world that's much bigger than this world, where everybody sees Krishna all the time. But that world we don't know about, Vaikuntha. So far as what we know, nobody's seen God. But we're just the prisoners in this material world, we're the minority. But as far as we know, nobody's ever seen God. But that's clarified in the second half. There are some who can see him in the heart, and they become immortal. Sadhaka bhaktas, those who practice sadhana bhakti, and they develop qualities of self-control, sense control, mind control, shama, dhamma, etc., they can gradually realize the Lord in their hearts by their practice of bhakti yoga. Because he's in the heart, he just has to be discovered there. One has to purify his heart, cheto dharpana marjanam. Purify the mirror of the heart. Those who know him by these two processes, ridha and manasa. So rid means the heart, manas means mind, but again there's a more figurative, more technical explanation of both of these processes here. Rit, the mind, means the mind, or rather rit heart, means a heart which is endowed with devotion, that one is obtained by the mercy of the qualified spiritual master. That is, through the heart that is endowed with devotion because of the mercy of one spiritual master. And manas means with a mind that is purified by the power of following the process of bhajan, bhajana kriya. One gets the strength, the spiritual strength, to actually remember the Lord in his pastimes. That is manas. This is a very intimate concept. Lila Smaranam, remembering the Lord's pastimes and his name and his form. Rupa Smaranam. These are intimate processes of devotional service that are being hinted at here. Just by the word manas. At least as explained in the commentary. Rid means with a heart that's been purified by the blessings of the pure devotee. And manas means with a mind that has been empowered to remember the Lord, his pastimes, and so on. These are fit candidates for liberation. Okay, text 21. Two prayers to end up the chapter. Prayers addressed to Lord Rudra in his fearful feature. God can be understood as the destroyer in his aspect of the material, in relation to the material world. Because everything in the material world is going to be destroyed. That's the ultimate success of everything in material life, annihilation. So certainly God can be understood as the destroyer, because He's destroying everything in this world. Therefore, he's called Rudra. Okay, verse 21. Ajata ityevab kaschid biru papadyate rudra yate dakshinam mukham tena mam pahi nityam. Someone. So we're talking about the few people who can realize God in their heart. This is being described here. And then the prayer offered by such a person is stated here. Someone may realize that he is the unborn supreme. Then, struck with awe, such a person will approach him for shelter. O Rudra, Lord of Wrath, please watch over me, always, with your all-merciful countenance. So, this is not exactly the same process of devotional service that we've been taught to approach Krishna. You know, we don't come to Mangalarti trembling out of fear, you know, begging, you know, for not to be destroyed. But this is one way to approach God in fear. Not the way that we learned. Rudra, he conceived of as having five faces. And most of those faces are fearful. But he has one face, facing the south, that is kind face. So the devotee here is praying to Rudra's face facing the south. Please show me that kind face. O destroyer of the disease of material existence. Ruk means disease. Dravaka means dissolver. So you who dissolve the disease of material existence, Rudra, please don't be angry at me. Oh, so, I'm sorry, the next verse. You are unborn. You don't have any material qualities, ajata. One realizes the Lord is infinite, unborn, without any material qualities. Understanding that the Lord is a transcendental person, unborn and perfect. Then he thinks himself very fallen and approaches the Lord for his mercy and begs for him to be compassionate. He says, I meditate on your compassionate face. Please always protect me with this meditation. Please rid me of material existence. Only by the Lord's mercy does the jiva attain all his desires and avoids everything undesirable. Therefore, one should approach the Lord, the Supreme Lord alone, and pray to him for liberation, as the devotee prays here. It says, kaschid biru. Somebody becomes fearful and surrenders. Not everybody is going to. Only the more intelligent person will choose to surrender to the Lord. Don't expect everyone to. Okay, one last verse, which is originally from the Rig Veda. It's a very old verse. Madas toke, mada ayushi. Mano goshu mana ashveshu rivishaha vira mano rudra bhavito vadhir havishmanta sadasi tva havamahe. O Rudra, do not be antagonistic to our children, our cows, our horses, and our duration of life. Do not become angry and destroy everything we have. We bring oblations to you, for you, in the sacrifice and offer them to you. So please, prayer is, don't be angry at me and destroy me because I have material attachments. Please excuse me for these transgressions of being attached to my family, my property, and so on. I'm coming and I'm trying to offer worship to you, as unqualified as I am, as contaminated and attached as I am. Please accept my offering and don't destroy me and everything I have. Don't become angry. Because we are your devotees. Someone in person claims, I'm your devotee, please don't destroy me. Krishna is obliged to accept the service. Either directly or indirectly. Better to approach the Lord through his devotee than try to approach him directly. Just like Prabhupada explained, the spiritual master, when he installs the deity in the temple, he asks Krishna, please accept my disciples' service. I know they're very imperfect and they may commit many offenses against you. But I'm asking you, please accept their service. Then, because the pure devotee is asking Krishna, Krishna is obliged to accept the disciples' worship, even though it's full of faults. That's a basic principle of a practical devotional service. We serve through our spiritual master. He asks Krishna to accept our service, even though it's unacceptable, and Krishna is obliged to take it, to accept it. So we can pray like this, especially better to approach Krishna through our spiritual master. We don't have to be afraid of God if we have that buffer of letting our spiritual master offer our service for us. Dwe akshare bhava pare tvanante vidya vidye nihite yatra gurhe kshanam tva vidya yamitam tu vidya vidya vidye ishate yas tu sonya. In the incorruptible soul, the jiva soul, in the incorruptible soul are hidden two subtle energies, knowledge and ignorance. Both are eternal servants of the Supreme. Ignorance is fallible, but knowledge is immortal. The Supreme who rules over knowledge and ignorance is separate from both. So we've been talking mostly about the Supreme Lord the last few chapters. Now, at least for one verse, we're turning our attention to the jiva soul and his condition. He's subject to two different influences, the influence of knowledge and the influence of ignorance. He's not simultaneously completely influenced by both. It's usually one or the other, or some combination. Different jivas are influenced different ways. Some are in total ignorance, some are totally liberated. There is an ambiguity here in the words, because it says there are two... this word Brahmapare, these two words, Brahmapare and tu anante, they can be understood two different ways grammatically because of the ending. This A ending A, pare anante, can be a subject case, meaning there are two entities, two energies found in the self, knowledge and ignorance. So, and that's what's, in Sanskrit you have what's called dual number. In other languages you have single and plural. But in Sanskrit you also have dual, exactly two, and then plural is more than two. So Brahmapare and Anante could refer to the two energies, knowledge and ignorance, that they are Brahmapara and Ananta. The knowledge and knowledge, which is according to Rama Ramanuja, the Sri Vaishnava version, ignorance is not illusion. Ignorance is karma. And vidya is jnana. So avidya is karma, which is performing Vedic sacrifices for temporary material benefits. That's called avidya, or literally ignorance. And vidya is the process of knowledge, as taught in the Upanishads, learning to understand the absolute truth for liberation, for eternal benefit. As it says in the Isha Upanishad, avidyayamrityum tirtva vidyayamritam ashnute. So Ramanujacharya's original explanation of this is that by performing Vedic sacrifices, by avidya, by what is technically called ignorance, one crosses beyond death. One actually purifies himself of his material contamination by performing Vedic sacrifice. And then, from that point on, he can cultivate knowledge. When he's qualified by having purified himself through performing sacrifices, he's then a fit candidate to take up the process of jnana. And by transcendental knowledge, as taught in the Upanishads, then he can taste amritam, immortality. So the two processes go together. This ignorance, this avidya and vidya process, are they're coordinate. That's the Sri Vaishnava way of interpreting it. So, in that sense, both vidya and avidya, both material knowledge and spiritual knowledge, knowledge of sacrifices, ritual knowledge, and knowledge of the Supreme, both kinds of knowledge, are Brahmapada. They're both dedicated to the Supreme. Just the karmic knowledge, the knowledge of the Karmakanda, is more indirectly, less directly, dedicated to the Supreme. The fruits of sacrifice are all offered to the Supreme, the Yajna Purusha, And the purpose of a person performing these sacrifices is to purify him so he can approach the Supreme gradually. So the karmakanda process, material knowledge of sacrifice, is also dedicated to the Supreme. And the jnana, the vidya, transcendental knowledge of the Upanishads, is more directly dedicated to the Supreme. The Upanishads openly glorify and describe the qualities of the Supreme, as far as it can be done without naming him directly. And they're both eternal. The process of the Vedic sacrifice, the process of jnana taught in the Upanishads, both of these are eternal. But another, grammatically, another way to analyze the two words brahmapare and anante is that they're in what's called the locative case, meaning in. And it's describing, in this second interpretation, the two words are describing the jiva soul. In the jiva soul, who is, he's brahmapara and he's ananta. The jiva soul belongs to the Supreme, and his eternal function is to serve the Supreme. So he's called brahmapara, the jiva. And the jiva is eternal. In that jiva, who is brahmapara and who is ananta, there are these two potencies affecting him, the potency of ignorance and the potency of knowledge. So the other way of looking at explaining these two ideas of vidya and avidya is that avidya is material illusion, the power that of maya to keep us trapped in the cycle of birth and death by inducing us to misidentify ourselves with the material body and everything connected with it. That's avidya, the power of illusion. And vidya is the opposite. It's the transcendental knowledge coming from the Vedas that leads us to liberation, to freedom from this entanglement. Someone may complain, someone may raise an objection, that we don't hear in the Shruti that Brahman contains vidya and avidya. But actually, Brahman has these two potencies. They belong to him. It's just that he's not affected by them. He's beyond the influence of knowledge and ignorance. Because they're his energies. He totally controls them. And he uses them to control the jiva souls. With avidya, he creates the material entanglement of the jivas with illusion. And with spiritual knowledge coming from the Vedas, he helps the jivas to become free. So he uses these two energies. He's not at all affected by them himself. But we can't say that they are found in him, because he's their possessor. And he's utilizing them to control the jivas. These two energies of knowledge and ignorance. Vidya vidya ishite yastu sonya. The one person who's controlling both of these energies, he's separate. He's unaffected by them, he's beyond them. And he's the one. Only by his grace, by his satisfaction, can one become a fit candidate for this transcendental knowledge that leads to liberation. That's why there's so many prayers here addressed to him. Please give us the pure intelligence by which we can know you. We can't, on our own strength, gain this transcendental intelligence. So that attitude, that understanding that one has to get the Lord's favor, the Supreme's favor, in order to understand him and become fit candidate for liberation, that is clearly stated here many times in this Upanishad. It's one of the major themes. It'll be stated in the very last verse of the last chapter. Well, these energies act directly on our consciousness. Our consciousness is an internal quality. It's not like our body, something we wear on the outside. Although our consciousness is something that's just a quality that belongs to us, but it's an internal quality. You know, it's directly connected to the soul. These two energies invade that consciousness. So in that way, they get inside the soul. They're hidden because the soul doesn't see their influence. Yeah, it's invisible to the soul himself. He doesn't realize he's in ignorance. And the devotee who's under the influence of Yogamaya, he doesn't see that influence too. It's also, you know, acting behind the scenes, invisibly.
Yes, I mean, it's hidden from the soul.
It's hidden from any other soul. You know, if I examine another soul, I probably cannot analyze his ignorance and knowledge completely. I may get some hints. Only God, you know, is able to see everything properly. So the action of the Lord's subtle energies is hidden to almost everybody except for God himself. And when he wants to reveal the workings of his subtle energies to somebody, he can. Some great devotee or sage can be given some insight, but it's rare. Usually nobody sees how these energies are working.
So, are they here?
He says incorruptible here. That means that his corruption is only apparent. The soul seems to be totally corrupted. It is illusion conditioned. But that's just a superficial covering. You know, nothing's happened to the soul. There's no permanent damage done to him, even in his millions of lifetimes of material existence. He's actually incorruptible. When he gets free from this covering of illusion, he's just as good as he was before. So he's incorruptible. And he's underneath the covering, he's completely pure. Every jiva soul. That's our philosophy. It's not everybody's philosophy. Even in the one school of Vaishnavism, the Madhva Sampradaya, although we officially belong to the Madhva Sampradaya, the traditional Madhvites think that there are different kinds of souls, and not all the souls are completely pure. Only the ones who are actually constitutionally in the mode of goodness. Those who are constitutionally in the mode of passion or ignorance, they'll never become liberated. They can't. They don't have the potential. Because they're not completely pure. God made them that way. That's their philosophy. So this is an important point. It's based on Shastra, but not even all the Vaishnavas, at least the Madhvites, don't appreciate this fact that every spirit, jiva soul is Vishuddha Sattva, is perfectly pure. The Madhvites will say that the verses in the Upanishads describing the jiva as Shuddha Sattva are just describing some of the jivas, not all of them. Those jivas that are Shuddha Sattva. We say no, every jiva is perfectly pure. That means every jiva can go back to Godhead.